Well, how often do you hear about the new fault line in global democratic politics? That both major centre-left and centre-right parties are splintering, both here and abroad. Now, you may recall my recent interview with Mark Latham, the former Labor leader, who's just been elected to the New South Wales upper house as a One Nation legislator. Now, he explained how One Nation was identifying with low-educated, working-class groups who'd been disoriented by the pace of socioeconomic change. As a result, they were taking votes away from the coalition parties. A bit like Marine Le Pen hurting the French Conservatives, or Nigel Farage and UKIP hurting the British Tories. Well, the left has its own political fault lines, as a new novel attests. This book of fiction is called Comeback. It's published by Scribe. And the author is, in my judgment, one of our nation's most prominent federal cabinet ministers whose political life was cut short. Lindsay Tanner was the federal member for Melbourne from 1993 to 2010 and a former finance minister in the Labor government of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. G'day, Lindsay. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
Now, your book is set in inner city Melbourne. This is an electorate that Arthur Calwell represented from, I think it was about 1940 to 72. You represented it for 17 years. It's been green territory since you left office. Tell us about your central character, this 50-something Jack Van Doon.
Jack's a grumpy, lonely, late middle-aged taxi driver who's been left behind by life, partly through his own slackness, but also circumstances. He's reasonably smart, but he's just drifted and he's pretty unhappy with the world. He lives by himself in a cruddy flat and he just gets involved in stuff that turns his life upside down. And I use him as a bit of a vehicle to look at a whole lot of things through somebody who is pretty low in the pecking order socially, and to also illustrate that the world looks very different if you're living in precarious financial and housing circumstances. So it's really just a wander through a part of the world of inner Melbourne that people are not really aware of, but was very central to my role as a federal member of parliament.
Yeah, and as you say, this backdrop, the redevelopment of public housing flats where this guy, he's a crabby, he's desperate Jack, he meets a dodgy property developer, unionists, public servants, refugee welfare centre and so on, and his life is thrown into turmoil. How so?
Well, he just stumbles into all this situation because he's happened to have witnessed an industrial accident on a small site next door to where he lives, where a bloke gets killed, and this is what gets the CFMEU involved. And suddenly, because he's a witness there and there's some people who have got some strong interests in covering this up and avoiding major investigations, he becomes a target. And so he then stumbles from one crisis to another trying to keep himself alive.
Yeah, the other inner city, I think you call it. Now, many people just assume our housing arrangements are stable, but this bloke, Jack, shows that this is not the case, right?
Exactly, and he bumps into a figure from his past who is now homeless, and Jack's antagonistic, this guy, and wants to get rid of him, but he ends up sort of stuck with him. And that also isn't, as you hear this guy's story unfold, you start to see that the phenomenon of homelessness is complex, and it's, you know, probably attributable some poor choices along the line being made by individuals. Not all the time, but in some cases, yes. But a lot of the time, it's just stuff happens. You know, this is not a bunch of other people, a different species from you, the ordinary person. In other circumstances, this could be you or you could be Jack.
My guest is former Federal Labor Minister Lindsay Tanner, and we're chatting about his new novel, Comeback. Now, given this story, Lindsay, how do the Greens, and of course they now run the show, if you like, in Melbourne since 2010, how do they relate to this inequality in their neighbourhoods?
Well, one of the things that really disturbed me in the latter period as the member, and this is really about the people who are voting for the Greens, not so much the party itself, but for the voters who have now pushed their primary vote in the federal electorate of Melbourne up to 43%.
No.
The bulk of those voters who make that difference live in expensive, renovated inner city houses. They're typically professional couples on collective high incomes. in secure professional jobs, a lot of them in the public sector, in the education sphere, in sort of comparable positions. These people collectively were very strong advocates of human rights and social justice, mm-hmm. but they were living literally next door to some of the poorest, most disadvantaged, most precariously positioned people in Australia, particularly in the high-rise flats. And they barely knew these people existed. Mm. And the classic example of this was primary schools, where you would literally have in numerous suburbs one smallish primary school that overwhelmingly served the kids of the high-rise flats, and another one walking distance away that was much richer, much larger, that served the children of the upper middle class professionals. And there was virtually no contact between them. Now, I understand the forces producing this, but it used to frustrate me. What you'll see is that the core reason why our politics has become so messy in recent years is that both major political forces are split down the middle by these fundamental disagreements. Mm. Both major political forces have large support bases amongst the university educated, and both major political forces have large support bases amongst those who either didn't finish school or are older or have much less education, much more routine labour involvement in the production process. And so they're dancing around a lot of the time these fundamental disagreements, whether it's about climate change, refugees, guns, economic interventionism, all of these issues, and it's very difficult for both parties.
And I guess education just reinforces those fault lines. In your recent interview with Troy Bramston in the Oz, in the Australian, you said the political class is overwhelmingly dominated by people with a university education, but a voting majority do not have a uni education. And this was your point. This has contributed to those populist insurgencies threatening to upend established parties.
That's absolutely correct. And it's not that difficult for somebody who's highly educated and capable of absorbing and analysing information to develop an analysis and a message that is ostensibly pertinent to the interests of the less well-off and people who are struggling and people who weren't highly educated and whose wages are under pressure. But what's very hard is to have an emotional connection and actually see the world through their eyes and understand what matters and how they perceive the forces that are pushing them around. And I don't think many politicians are really able to do that.
You're seeing this also around the world. I mean, I've spent time in Washington and New York, and they're completely different kind of environments to middle America, or in, say, London and Westminster is completely different from, say, Northern England. It's the same sort of divide, isn't it?
That's right. It's not something any individuals or any party should be blamed for. It's just the way that the production process and our economies and education systems have evolved. So that in the world I grew up in, I was destined for higher education, you know, probably from a relatively early age, but I grew up overwhelmingly amongst people who weren't.
Yeah. And on that note, I'm sorry, but what about identity politics? Where does that fit into this? Because from my perspective, it seems to divide people along, you know, racial, gender and ethnic lines. And the Greens especially are embracing this identity politics. How does that fit into your narrative?
It's clearly a major development that reflects that emergence of the dominant educated upper middle class in the progressive spectrum, because it spins off legitimate and important abstract concerns about the fairness of the overall society. But the problem has been that it's been pursued to a degree at the expense of the ordinary, legitimate day-to-day concerns of people who are not who don't identify with those specific categories. It's perfectly legitimate and important to pursue those concerns for people on the progressive side of politics. But the worrying thing, particularly in the United States, is that that is almost being done as a replacement for the pursuit of the concerns of the ordinary working people in an aggregated sense. And so it's not surprising that people are saying, well, you know, Donald Trump's talking to me and those people are talking to someone else.
Exactly. Now, what about this idea of Labor forming an alliance with the Greens? Because your former colleague, Julia Gillard, after the 2010 election, she did form an alliance with Bob Brown. Didn't quite work out well, but you still do hear calls that it makes sense for Labor to get closer to the Greens. I take it you're against that idea?
I'm completely against it. The critical thing that's become increasingly obvious is the Greens are primarily in competition with Labor. A report was done by the Greens internally after the 2004 election about my electorate, where they went backwards after coming close to beating me in 2001. And though it was absolutely brutal in its statements, it just said, we're not in the business of defeating John Howard. That's not a strategic priority. We're in the business of taking votes from Labor. And so for Labor to form alliances with a party that's actually dedicated to Labor's ultimate political destruction, in my view, is silly. We've just got to face the reality that our options are complicated by the existence of the Greens. People are entitled to vote for them. The Greens are entitled to win seats in Parliament and to make their own choices. But for Labor to somehow see them as some kind of junior partner that we can happily coexist with, I think is very short-sighted.
Okay, now finally, the Greens are more upper middle class, as we've discussed, and they have no real interaction with the Jacks of Melbourne. Now, given all of that and given your thesis in your novel, how then does Labor try to win back an inner city seat like Melbourne?
I think it's got to be a long game for Labor, and these things do go a bit in cycles. We can't really predict how strong the Greens will be in future. It may well be that they hold my old seat for a long time. You don't know, but you've just got to keep chipping away at it and try and stay reasonably principled and coherent, because the key weapon that Labor's got is always results, outcomes. The Greens might make you feel better. They might give you the warm inner glow because you can indulge your own moral vanities. Labor's imperfect. It compromises, it sometimes does wrong things, but it actually changes the country, and that's what matters.
Lindsay, great to have you on RN today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Lindsay Tanner, the former senior Labor cabinet minister. He's author of Comeback. That's just out by Scribe, and we'll put a link on our website.